WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new book, Understanding Terror Networks, was written by a former CIA agent. But you wouldn't know that from reading the book. It wasn't until after its completion that the author, Mark Sageman, revealed he'd worked undercover with the Afghan Mujahideen when he was based in Pakistan in the late 80s. In a few minutes, he'll explain why he recently revealed his secret identity. Sageman is a forensic psychiatrist who now teaches at the University of Pennsylvania and its Center for Study of Ethno-Political Conflict. His new book challenges some preconceptions about why people join jihadi groups. His conclusions are based on his study of biographical data on 172 participants in the jihad. I asked him first about his reaction to the Bush administration's new warning that al-Qaeda is plotting a major attack on the U.S. this summer. Now, we were just warned by the FBI and the Justice Department that al-Qaeda or terrorists are planning another major attack in the United States, and there's particular fears that the attack might be against big events like the political conventions. What do you think about when you hear that?
Well, there's no doubt that al-Qaeda really wants to hurt the United States, so their desire is real. But what has changed since 9/11 is the vigilance inside the United States and at the borders preventing them from performing such a large operation. So I tend to be fairly skeptical, not so much because of the al-Qaeda desire to actually carry out such operation, but our ability to stop them.
Okay, so you're skeptical that the terrorists will actually be successful at pulling off another terrorist attack over the summer. But let me point out something else that you've said. The Bush administration says that we've succeeded in killing or imprisoning much of the leadership of al-Qaeda. And you've said, sure, that's the 2001 leadership that we've done away with, but now there's the 2004 leadership, and we haven't hurt them. So if you think that al-Qaeda is back with a new leadership, in spite of all the people who we've killed or imprisoned, why are you reasonably sure that they wouldn't be successful in pulling off a terrorist attack?
My level of certainty is really to the side of the attack, as opposed to carrying out an attack. I mean, you can always have a single person, a singleton, going out to the LL counter, let's say in Los Angeles, and kill two people. That is almost impossible to prevent. But what's very possible to prevent is a large-scale operation. And since 9/11, al-Qaeda has changed quite a bit. The new leadership is a very young, aggressive, reckless leadership. And so operation after 9/11 have multiplied. There are far more operations after 9/11 against targets all over the world than were before 9/11, but they were poorly planned. And were not as lethal as 9/11. Even though perhaps a Madrid bombing was extremely lethal. But again, this was a fairly a rush job. It was put together in about 6 to 8 weeks.
Can you talk a little bit more about the difference between the new al-Qaeda leadership and the pre-9/11 al-Qaeda leadership?
Yes, it seemed that before 9/11, they had a more hierarchical overlay over the various clusters of small organizations in various countries, and they were able to coordinate a little bit better. This was a much older type of leadership, if you can call it leadership. What happened is that after you degrade the network by really eliminating the communication between leaders that can help in terms of planning and money and training and even give advice, you local people, aggressive local young men, then step into those gaps. And, for instance, like al-Zarqawi that we hear a lot right now.
This is the man believed to be the person who decapitated Nick Berg.
That's correct, yes. So you almost select, it's for young, aggressive leaders to local leaders, not really global leaders anymore, but local leaders, like, for instance, perhaps Amer Azizi in Madrid. And those leaders, if you think of the analogy of the war on drugs, where the police comes in and arrests the fellow who's at the street corner, well, there's a gap. And what happens is that you have an intense internal competition, and the most aggressive wins out. So you have a progressive self-selection for aggression and aggressive young leaders who may not have the global vision of the old leadership, but are just as lethal locally.
So it sounds from what you're saying that you think in some ways we're better off than we were before September 11th in terms of being able to stop terrorist threats. But in other ways, we're worse off because we have a younger, more reckless leadership, and there's probably a lot more people out there who see themselves as potential suicide bombers or terrorists.
That's correct. I think that's exactly right.
The International Institute for Strategic Studies just released a report saying that overall the risks of terrorism to Westerners and Western assets in Arab countries appears to have increased after the Iraq War. Agree with that?
No. I smiled when I saw the number 18,000 members of Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is an organization that network has what I call fuzzy boundaries. That means that it's very hard to actually tell who is in Al-Qaeda and who is not. It has now become more of a collection of local organizations where local young men decide to, with their friends, carry out operation. Do they think of themselves as Al-Qaeda? Probably not. And this was the case in Casablanca. Casablanca, they were part of the overall movement called Jihadia Salafia, but they didn't even call themselves that. It's usually journalists and local law enforcement officers who put a label on this movement. It's really a bunch of friends getting together and carrying out those operations. So when I see 18,000, there is no formal induction into Al-Qaeda anymore. And I'm just wondering how do they go about looking at this number? There is no doubt to my mind, because of what happened in Iraq, that the potential number of people who want to carry out this operation has grown. But whether they will or not is an open question.
And you don't think they're all reporting to the same guy?
Well, again, the hierarchical levels of command has broken down. So it's really very much a collection of local phenomena.
My guest is forensic psychiatrist Mark Sageman, author of Understanding Terror Networks. He'll explain why he recently revealed he's a former undercover CIA agent after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Mark Sageman. He teaches at the University of Pennsylvania. He's a former CIA agent and author of the new book, Understanding Terror Networks. In your book, you've tried to profile, to do portraits of people who join terrorist networks and understand why do they join. And you say that some of the myths, some of the assumptions that we make about why people join are really myths. They're not joining because they were indoctrinated. They're not joining because they were poor. A lot of the people are middle class. And you say that a lot of the reasons why people join is because they know other people in it. Could you talk about that? Why would that be a motivation?
Yes. Most people who actually join a part of the social group. In my data kind of fell into four large clusters, and they each have a separate type of perhaps not profile, but ways of getting to terrorist operation. The one that we would call the core Arab cluster really consists of really the elite of the core Arab world. And by core Arab world, I mean the Egyptian, Jordanian, Yemenis, Kuwaitis, Saudis. And because they're very the elite and they're good students, they send abroad to study. And while they're abroad, they become homesick and they become a little bit alienated, distant from their cultural bonds and the bonds to their friends. And they feel homesick, and therefore they drift toward mosques because that's where familiar sites and people are. They don't do that out of religiousness. They do that for social reason. And well, and when they're there, they kind of befriend other people. And they often move into apartments. For instance, the cell in Hamburg was exactly created that way. And there is an intensification there. They become of feelings and of friendship bonds and become very close to each other and very distant from the rest of their ambient society. So you have out-group hate and you have in-group love. And at the end of that process, they often are all willing or they all desire to join the jihad. And they do that collectively as a group. For instance, the Hamburg group, all eight of them decided to go to Afghanistan. And they went there in two waves. The first wave was, of course, the four pilots. And the second wave were the people who supported them.
There was a flowchart in The Atlantic magazine recently that you put together showing the leadership and the structure of al-Qaeda. It's the equivalent of like a corporate flowchart, but for al-Qaeda. But unlike a corporate flowchart where there's the CEO at the top, the vice president's beneath the CEO, the middle manager's beneath that, it's kind of a pyramid. So what your flowchart is more of a flowchart showing who knows who rather than who takes orders from who.
That's correct, because most of the orders, most of the operations are decentralized, and it's more of a collective decision-making process as opposed to a single person making up a plan. And in my book, I argue that that type of strict, rigid, hierarchical flow of information is a sure recipe for failure, especially in terrorist operation. You really needed an informal network to be able to overcome the inevitable obstacles that you have in the field. Because when you want to actually perform a terrorist operation, you actually don't know what the target is, you don't know how you're going to do it, you don't know who you're going to do it with. So you really need a lot of flexibility and a lot of horizontal flow of information between the members who are going to carry it out to be able to carry out that type of operation.
You know, you have a file that you keep, a matrix of people who are known to be in the international jihadi movement. And who knows who? Who's affiliated with who? And after the terrorist attack on Madrid, you went into that network and came up with some interesting information. What did you find?
Yes. If you recall, the Madrid operation happened on a Thursday. By Saturday, the Moroccan authorities released the three names of the three suspects. So one of them was Jamal Zougham, and I ran Jamal Zougham against my database, which included Judge Baltazar Garzon's 700-page indictment. And his name, Zougham's name, appeared on page 89 and 285 of the indictment. And it said that he was very close to Yarkas, Barakat Yarkas, who is also named Abu Dada. And he was the head of the al-Qaeda Spanish cell. So I finally made the link to al-Qaeda. That was on Sunday morning, emailed the information to CNN, which released it as a worldwide scoop from Madrid on Sunday.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Mark Sageman. He teaches at the University of Pennsylvania. He's the author of the new book, Understanding Terror Networks, and he's a former CIA agent. But you wouldn't know he's a former CIA agent, no matter how closely you read his new book. And that is because, Mark, you were not out of the closet, so to speak, about being a former CIA agent when you wrote this book. It was only after you wrote it that you revealed you are a former agent. What made you reveal that part of your past?
Mainly two things. One is, of course, a Valerie Plame affair. I came into the agency in 1984 as a NOC, which is an unofficial cover officer, which are the assignment of being sent abroad without being linked to official Americans like an embassy. And, of course, you can then go to denied areas, areas denied to official Americans. And this is very dangerous because you don't have the safety net of being an official American where you have diplomatic immunity. So if you're arrested, you may be shot. And this was the position that Valerie Plame was at. So I felt very strongly about this. Larry Johnson, who is, of course, the person who spearheads a movement to find out who leaked the name, asked me to put my name to a letter that he sent to Congress, and so I signed that letter. That's number one. And the second reason is the superb book by Steve Cole that revealed a lot of the programs that I started and ran for 3 years in Afghanistan.
And Steve Cole is the author of a book about Afghanistan, and he's with the Washington Post. He's an editor there.
That's correct. It's called Ghost Wars.
Can you talk about what your job was when you were undercover with the CIA, based in Pakistan and working with Afghanistan?
Most of my job consisted of leveling the playing field. If you remember, all
I should say, this is like 87 to 89, we're talking?
That's correct. Okay. That was at the end of the Afghan War, before the Soviets had publicly stated that they were going to withdraw, and up to the time of the withdrawal. So my program was really designed for three purposes. One was this, level the playing field, which means we were going to unilaterally, unbeknownst to the Pakistani, it was not declared to the Pakistanis, to provide support and advice to commanders that have been neglected or relatively neglected by the Pakistanis. The second, we wanted to make sure that the Pakistanis were really being honest with us, so I was collecting information by what the Pakistanis were doing. If you recall, there was a lot of money involved, and there were a lot of concern around Washington that perhaps some of that was siphoned out into their own pockets. And it turned out that the Pakistanis actually were pretty honest in terms of helping us run the war. And the third was, of course, to collect information on how the war was going and develop our own unilateral contacts to find out.
Why did you want to join the CIA?
That's a very good question. I'm a child of Holocaust survivors. And in a way, since I was born after World War II, I never really got to defend my family, perhaps retrospectively. But children of Holocaust survivors always have the Holocaust on their mind. So when I was in Japan as a flight surgeon for the U.S. Navy, all the rumors of the genocide in Cambodia came out. And it was very hard to believe that this was happening again. And I felt the military was not doing very much. So I simply wrote a letter to the CIA and said, gee, you guys may actually, you know, you may want me, you know, I speak foreign languages, I'm a physician. And of course, by return mail, they said, yes, we do. And my security clearance and my process of joining took about a year.
So you thought that if you joined the CIA, you would be more useful than you are in the military in terms of helping to stop this type of genocide?
Yes. If you remember, you know, the next genocide to me after Cambodia was, of course, Afghanistan. The early years of the Soviet invasion, about 1.5 million Afghans were killed. 8 million were displaced. 5 million were outside refugees. 3 million were in Pakistan. 2 million were in Iran. And you had 3 million internally displaced, where they swelled up the population of Kabul and Kandahar and Mazar-e-Sharif, names that now we're all familiar, but at that time nobody was. And so to me, this was as much a disaster as any large-scale epidemic. So I was still a physician looking at it from a humanitarian point of view, and I thought that this was a very clear-cut situation that the Soviets had to go back to prevent or to stop this genocide that was going on in Afghanistan.
Okay, so you go to Islamabad to try to help prevent this kind of mass death in Afghanistan. You're a Holocaust survivor. Your parents are Holocaust survivors. You're Jewish. And you're now based in a part of the world that is growing at that time increasingly anti-Semitic. And now, I mean, we see how truly rapidly anti-Semitic the jihadi movement is. How aware were you then of this kind of growing strain of anti-Semitism?
Well, the Afghans were not really anti-Semitic during the war. Some of them argued that there's a lost tribe. The Afghan tribes, the Pashtun tribes, were the lost tribes. But if you recall, at the time, Yasser Arafat, the chairman of the PLO, was very pro-Soviet, and therefore he supported the Soviet Union in their policy on Afghanistan, and every Afghan knew that. And so they were not pro-Palestinian, because to them, Yasser Arafat was the head of the Palestinian people. And in my contact with a lot of the Afghan mujahideen, they were telling me, gee, after we finish with the Soviets here, well, we can go to Israel and clean up the mess for you. And I was saying, no, please, don't muddy the situation.
So you didn't have to hide the fact that you were Jewish?
Oh, yes, I did.
You did hide it?
Yes.
Why?
Well, as you kind of pointed out, Al-Qaeda now claims that it was Allah, or God, that vanquished, conquered the Soviet Union. And I didn't really want them to know that behind Allah stood Jehovah in Pakistan. That would just muddy the water, not only with the Afghans, but also with the Pakistani inter-services intelligence directorate, who would probably have put more surveillance on me, which is something I definitely did not need. So I decided to actually have a low profile.
My guest is forensic psychiatrist and former CIA agent Mark Sageman. His new book is called Understanding Terror Networks. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is forensic psychiatrist and former CIA agent Mark Sageman. His new book is called Understanding Terror Networks. Part of what you do now is you work as a forensic psychiatrist.
Yes.
So you deal with crime, you've dealt with serial killers, and of course you're still doing work on understanding terrorists and the jihadi network. Do you see any connection between, say, the mind of a serial killer and the mind of a terrorist, only because they both end up committing murder?
No, actually, I don't. But I almost had to have that experience with serial killers for me to understand the difference. I see terrorism really as very much a group phenomenon, or terrorism, the Al-Qaeda type of terrorism, as opposed to, for instance, a Ted Kaczynski, who also could be considered as terrorist, but Ted Kaczynski was a loner. And the loners may have something wrong with them psychologically or psychiatrically. And so a serial murderer or a mass murderer, and they're very different, may have something psychologically wrong with them, and they're loners and they act out of their internal drive. But terrorism is very, very different. It's really a group phenomenon. You can't really have terrorism like Al-Qaeda without having friends to motivate, sustain your desire, your enthusiasm, especially when you kill yourself the same way a lot of the Al-Qaeda agents have. This is very much you're doing it for your comrades and for your God. But in fact, he's really doing it for his friends. He's really trying to show the ultimate loyalty to this band of brothers. And we've known that for a long time, since all the studies were done on soldiers in World War II, where people fought because of their friend, not because of any ideological reason, up to just about any kind of studies in social psychology in the last half century. This has supported this view of why people do those things.
So you actually see a connection between suicide bombers and the American soldier, that both are willing to give their lives for their comrades, but the concept of how and why are really different.
That's correct. And if you see most Medal of Honor winners are people who jumped on a grenade to save their bodies. I think it's almost a majority. And it's similar, except people tell you, well, perhaps the guy who jumped on the grenade didn't have time to think about it. But you see, I think the instinct is very similar.
Now, it's just been a couple of months, maybe, since you came out as a former CIA agent. How has your life changed? I imagine people who know you are kind of stunned to find that out.
Many people suspected. People who knew me suspected. Probably my family was the most surprised.
Your family didn't know?
Yes, my parents, my sister, they didn't know. My niece did not know. My wife did know, I told her. But it's still the same old me.
What was your parents' reaction?
I'm not really sure they still understand.
Right, right. Mark Sageman, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Mark Sageman is a forensic psychiatrist and former CIA agent. He teaches at the University of Pennsylvania and its Center for Study of Ethno-Political Conflict. His new book is called Understanding Terror Networks.